Donald Trump won a huge victory, taking every Las Vegas demographic. Elvis impersonators, white tiger handlers, even master illusionists. Wait, wait, where did he go? No! Yay! No! Yeah! How did you? How?
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Hey everybody, welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul. Dennis Freebe is not here this week, mainly because I am sick and I can't talk for more than 30 seconds. But we have a great interview for the from the amazing Blake Voigt, a wonderful magical inventor, worked with David Copperfield, David Blaine, has been on Fool Us, has been on Wizard Wars, done a whole bunch of great things. Really nice guy. Really fun interview. Real quick, if you want to follow us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Two Magicians. And if you want to send us some fan mail, hate mail, fun gig stories, you can email us to twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. And that's also our website, twomagiciansonemic.com, if you want to find past episodes. Also, please rate us on iTunes. It takes about 30 seconds. Put in a nice little review there, and it greatly helps out the podcast in ratings and just getting more people to subscribe. And also, if you want to give us a dollar or two or three, you can do that to our PayPal, or there's a link right on the website, which is our PayPal email is twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. Okay, that's enough pandering and begging for money. Now, the interview with the great Blake Voigt.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Blake.
How do you say your last name?
Voigt. It's Voigt. Very complicated when looking at it.
Okay. I'm terrible with the English language, so yeah. I always want to say Voigt.
No, that's fine. Voigt. I answer to anything. I've heard way worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but my last name is Paul, and people find a way to screw that up, so I can only imagine.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yep. Like, how do you spell that? P-A-U-L. What? Yeah, it's confusing. But anyway, we're hiding here in the... We're sneakily doing this in the Magic Castle, just without permission. But technically, we got permission.
Yeah, loose permission.
They're really chill today.
Yeah.
But thank you for doing this free podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is cool.
So you are, we have all, you're a performer as well as an inventor of magic. And we've never had, I don't think, any inventors of magic on here. And so maybe if you could take me through that process. How do you build something? How do you play off an idea and you know, bring it to fruition.
I think I didn't ever set out to be a magic inventor. I'm like first and foremost and always a performer. And whenever I was in high school, I had a restaurant gig where I did like 3 hours of magic every Monday for like 2 years. So it was a lot of magic, a lot, like frequently. And I started tweaking tricks that I had bought to make them fit me. So like I would change the premise first, and then I'm naturally like a tinkerer, so I like taking things apart and putting them back together, and have a like industrial design background in college.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, so like it just spawned from me tweaking other people's stuff until all of a sudden I realized what I was doing had no comparison to where it started. And then I realized that I could start off with a new premise or a new trick or something. So that's where it kind of came from. But it was all with the intention of performing. I've never really ever created something to create it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I would find it hard to find motivation to create something just to sell. Or, you know, I think some guys are do that and they're really good at it.
Yeah.
I just can't wrap my head around it. So.
Yeah. Same thing. That's interesting that you come at it. I'm the same way. I come from a performer's perspective. Yep. So what's your history with performance? Do you have any theater background?
I love singing. So I have a singing background. Cool. Was in like show choir and musicals and stuff. And then in college, I was in an all-men's singing group. So got a lot of stage experience through that. And then I've just always done shows. I think the first show I did was freshman year of high school for like my golf coach's daughter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was a learning experience. But I learned that I loved it, and kind of all spawn from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're full-time magic, correct?
Yes, yeah. Full-time magic. Mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to create magic specifically for David Copperfield, David Blaine, like Dynamo, and musicians, and like for movies and television and stuff. And so the consulting and creating work has become a big part of my career, like as far as making money goes. But at the end of the day, I love performing more.
And that's what I meant. I know, yeah. Obviously, I know you're a full-time magician, but I wasn't sure how much consulting you did versus performing.
Probably maybe half and half right now, and I would love for it to be more performing.
Sure.
But just because I've had opportunities to create for bigger names in magic, that carries a lot more weight than the bigger shows or lack of bigger shows I've done.
And how does that come about? Is it just word of mouth, or do you create something and pitch it to somebody?
The consulting or the performing?
Well, I mean, I'm a performer, and yeah, I still don't know how I get booked. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Yep. But as far as consulting goes.
Yeah, I think it's word of mouth. I think magic consultant is a confusing term to the majority of people in the world. And so there aren't very many people who would say they are a magic consultant. So it's not a very competitive line of work.
So if somebody's like searching for it, they can find it.
Yeah, and if they don't find me, they find one of my friends. I mean, a lot of my closest friends are magic consultants, and I've worked well with my friends. And so if they don't find me, they find one of my friends, and then I get a job through them. So.
And it seems like, you know, if you have that title, you know, you either know what you're doing or you don't. And I'm sure that maybe reads, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, you would think, but I still don't know what I'm doing. And
well, I don't think any of us know. We're all faking it.
Fake it till you make it type of thing.
But I think, in terms of, like, being able to help people.
Yeah. I think one of my strengths that attracts me to teams that I work on is I don't have that big of an ego. So I think that can be kind of volatile in a creative atmosphere. Sure. Somebody who is not forward thinking in that they want the best idea picked. A lot of people want their idea picked. Mm. And I could care less because, you know, when David Blaine is doing a trick on the street on TV, he doesn't say, let me show you a Blake Boyd's trick. You know, it doesn't matter at the end of the day. So I'm all for the best idea being chosen. I think I'm pretty good at that, like removing my own self-interest in my ideas. And then under-promising and over-delivering is kind of important in any field or profession. But I think in a creative profession, it's even more important because there's a lot of guys who will promise these crazy outlandish ideas. And there's no way they can deliver them. And that's their first and last creative consultant job. Whereas if you go in and promise realistic ideas and either just deliver them or deliver more, you tend to get more work. Like one thing that I pride myself in, or I work this premise into my show and I perform, is the idea of like bad ideas or the value of them. So like whenever I was hired to work for David Blaine or David Copperfield, like at any point on a consulting job, there's a point where you're interviewed and you have a meeting, and like David Blaine asked me if I bring you on the team and we hire you, what good ideas do you promise you'll deliver? And I said, every single time, same answer, I say, I promise you zero good ideas, but I swear I'll be the guy that never runs out of bad ones. And I can deliver that promise, you know. And I think that there's a lot of value in having somebody on a team that just keeps spouting ideas.
Sure.
You know, whether they're
good
or not.
We could do this. We could do that.
Yeah. And 9 times out of 10, they're horrible. Or 99 times out of 100, they're horrible. But if I say something that's dumb, but, you know, another person's in the room might jump off of it and make it better.
So it's like a writer's room type situation.
Exactly. That's all it is, just for magic. So. Mm-hmm.
And where do you think that comes from, that lack of ego? Because magic is a pretty ego-driven medium. Right.
I mean, I'd be lying if I said no ego. I mean, obviously, it's super cool.
We all have to have some in order to get up on stage and I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah, exactly. But I think less of an ego than most would be because I think, like I was saying, I'm very like big picture oriented. Like, I know that I'm on a team that the big picture is we create cool stuff, or we create this end game thing. And like I'm saying, like, you know, it doesn't matter at the end of the day whose idea it is. But, you know, I think if we work collectively, I've never worked on a team or a non-team creatively, I don't think. I'm usually on a team with at least one or two other guys, if not more. So I think, you know, having a ego makes it not fun to be creative with somebody.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
a wall. You can't get anything yeah. through or
it
work
really
on.
Is just, you know, it comes down to the basics of improv comedy.
Yes.
You have to work as a group mind or else you're not going to get anywhere.
You yeah. never say no. Mm-hmm. I think surrounding yourself, like my closest friends that I work with creatively, I feel so comfortable with them because I know that even if I say the most horrendous idea, the worst that's going to happen is they'll laugh at me.
Sure.
And they won't like make fun of me or like they won't, you know, shun me for having a terrible idea because most of mine are bad ideas.
And I'm sure that's probably everybody.
Everybody.
You know, my notebook is chock full of ideas yeah. that there's no way in hell I can
exactly.
accomplish.
I think a big misconception is that there are creative people. I think there are just people who create more. And like people I've worked with, like two of the most clever dudes I've worked with are like a Kalen Morelli or a Daniel Garcia. And I think people think that Danny Garcia just like sits down and all that comes out of his mouth is gold. It's like, it's not, but I mean, a lot of it is. But
yeah.
I mean, like he just never stops coming up with ideas. And it's like some guys will, I've talked to people who are like, how do I invent a magic trick? And I'm like, well, how many have you tried inventing? Like,
sure.
you know, like, well, I wrote down like, you know, I tried 10 or 20 things. I'm like, yo, you got to like try 500 things before you're going to scratch the surface of something. And I think it's just having the mental strength to put up with all the bad stuff or wade through it, you know.
And probably the failure, just being able to manage that.
Yeah. Or being around people who know that that's the process as well. Like I've been around people who are hard to be creative around because I'll say five dumb ideas in a row and then they'll stop listening to me. And I'm
sure.
like, hang in there. I'm due. Hold on. You know, like,
yeah.
like
yeah.
You know? Whereas other guys will just stick it out for the long run, which is much more fun.
And that's important. I can relate to that big time, you know, just working on something or just, you know, if somebody writes you off immediately, whether it's somebody on your team or somebody you're pitching for, somebody you're performing for, that's hard to bounce back from.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And like you never know how long you're going to work on an idea. Like people have asked, how long do you work on something before you give it up or you move on? Like I've worked on an idea for years and all of a sudden one day I was in the shower and it, something clicked that made it a good trick, you know, or there's some things where I couldn't explain it and just right from the get-go it was a good idea, you know, but you have to go through so many bad ideas. I mean, there was a time in college where, forget who told me this advice, but I woke up and I wrote down 10 ideas for magic tricks every morning, right when I woke up. And even if they were the most horrendous things, you know, I wrote down 10, just either premises or concepts or ideas for gimmicks or anything. And then, you know, 1 month in, I had 300 ideas.
Sure.
One of them was good.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to just sitting around writing down nothing. And that was how, you know, one way I sparked.
That was one of the advice pieces I got from Second City. A lot of writer teachers were like, keep a notebook, write 10 things every day.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to pull from that.
Yeah.
And it's weird. I've never looked at magic the same way until you just said that.
It's the exact same way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like Second City and improv and comedy, like I am so much more obsessed with comedy performers than magicians.
Same, like, yeah.
I draw inspiration from my favorite stand-up people before I watch other magicians because I'm afraid of picking up their persona or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think also like the idea of writing stuff down, it removes the other people making fun of you because you're the only one that'll ever see that book. So there's no fear in writing down the dumbest idea.
It's just shutting off that part in your brain, the judgmental part.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's a fun creative exercise if you're looking to invent a magic trick or something.
And you do a daily magic trick on Instagram. Yeah. Is it on other mediums too?
It originated on Instagram, and now I post it on Twitter and Facebook because I have friends and family, and I know people who are only on one of the three, or they focus on one. So, but it is with the Instagram format in mind. So I always work within 15 seconds.
Okay.
Even though I post it to Twitter, which I think you can do 30, and Facebook you can do however long. But Instagram was where it originated.
Mm-hmm. And how did that come about? Just as like an exercise? Or?
Yeah, an exercise. I mean, kind of along a different version of the write down 10 tricks a day method. Make a video a day. I'm on day like 230 right now. So jeez. I've been doing it, and I haven't missed a day yet, which is great. And I do it that day. So I don't bank them, which is probably stupid, but,
it's all up in the Instagram cloud until, they get hacked.
But. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I mean, like, as far as like working ahead or having five ready to put them out, I don't do that. Like, I literally work within that day to try to come up with it. And I'm not, a while ago when I first met Kalen Morelli, he was doing 365 days of magic, and he was inventing a magic trick a day.
Oh, Jesus.
And that, I mean, he was killing it. I think he made it really far. And the thing that stopped it was Copperfield hired us. So it was like a good motivation.
It's a good reason to
stop. Yeah. But he, I think that was, I don't think I could ever do that. But so I'm doing other people's material sometimes. I'm doing some original content. But if I do someone else's effect, I try to at least perform it how I would perform it, not trying to emulate them or imitate them. But yeah, so it's been, I'm happy. I was just telling somebody that I'm happy with about one every 10 videos I do. I hate 9 of them. But I forced myself to put them up there because that one video I come up with, I wouldn't have come up with it if I hadn't made the other 9. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, 365 divided by 10, I'll have 36 videos in a year that I'm really stoked about.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's the same thing as performing as much as you can because there's stuff you're going to discover in a performance that there's no way you could have discovered.
Right.
While sitting, at home.
Right. And I think, there is a big difference between performing on Instagram and performing for real people.
Sure, sure.
I think...
I'm glad you know that.
Yeah.
Because you're probably a performer first. And I think there's 100%. A lot of YouTube and Vine stars out there who don't...
See the difference.
Or can't, when you throw them in front of a live audience, you just see, you don't get this.
No, I look at it as an entirely different muscle. Like, I think... Yeah. Social media and online and television even is such a visual medium, and people have such short time spans, attention spans online. Like, whereas if you get them in person in a room, like we're sitting in an awesome little theater right here where they're here to see you perform and you can perform for them.
They can't change the channel. They can't go check.
But if you're on Instagram and they're swiping their finger along, you got to keep their attention for 15 seconds or get it in 2 seconds or sometimes get it from the thumbnail. So it's like all of that thinking I think is really interesting.
Sure.
And it's just entirely like I very rarely apply something I've come up with for Instagram ever to what I do live.
Interesting.
I think that they're... Most of my Instagram videos are insanely angly, or like take me 36 takes to get that. I would never do that in front of a live audience, but that's not the medium I'm doing. So like, I think it's a missed opportunity for people that try to make Instagram videos like live videos because they're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it'd be like a painter trying to make a sketch of, colored pencil drawing. Like, they're completely different mediums. And I feel like, using an angly trick is fine for Instagram as long as you're making an Instagram video. You're not thinking you just created the next best.
And you're not going to try to sell it.
Exactly.
And go, this is the greatest thing that you can do in this corner of your house.
Yeah, tried and tested, angle proof, walk around ready, all that. No.
Mumbo jumbo, yeah. Did you do Fool Us last season?
I did, yep.
Yeah, how did that go?
It was really fun.
Did you fool them?
I did not.
Okay, but for some reason I thought you did.
You know, that line of thinking I did not foresee happening, and what you just said is what everybody says to me. Anybody that saw it or saw parts of it, they always ask, like, did you fool them? And, you know, very happy that that's the reaction and not people saying like, oh yeah, you're on there. You didn't fool them, right?
You know, like you were terrible.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they did a really great job as far as the producers go and Penn and Teller in creating a show where the competition is there to say it's a competition show, but like it's such a minor part of the show. Like the ultimate goal of the show is to put good magic on TV.
Sure.
And make it entertaining and give guys like me and other guys on the show an opportunity to be seen by more people. And they did that. Like, I think I didn't see every episode, but every episode I saw, whether I personally thought it was a good trick or a bad trick, even the bad ones, I was shocked at how great they made it look, mm-hmm. you know, or all of the nice things that they,
yeah,
have.
They were always very kind, yes. Which is great. And you know, they set it up like a, even though it is a reality show, it isn't.
Right.
They set it up like that just probably to sell it to the
yep.
network.
Yep.
And then I think they pulled their own trick of, no, we're just going to be nice to people and showcase good magic.
That's the best trick. I think they fooled the network mm-hmm. by making that show.
And now that it's been so successful, they're like, oh, well, all right, this is the format.
We'll keep doing it. Yep,
yeah.
Exactly. I think, yeah, I was really bummed whenever I, you know, didn't fool them. But then at the end of the day, like I've gotten so many performing opportunities and just a lot of great feedback from people seeing that clip. Like before that clip, like I posted it on YouTube on my own account. The most views I'd gotten was like a couple thousand for a video. And that video for me now has over 1 million views.
Wow.
And I would have never thought that. And I never would have thought it'd be a positive thing either. Like
sure.
crap. The only video I have up is of me losing a show, you know, big picture, like you could look at it that way, but nobody ever does, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like people will just finish watching it and then they'll say, wait, so did you win? Or like, you know, like,
yeah.
like they're not so negative when you don't fool them. They're very positive and, you know, like congrats to them for creating such a cool show
mm-hmm.
for magic like that.
Yeah. 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 It just, it's well done. I,
yeah.
It's one of the few shows. I'm not a huge fan of magic on TV, just for what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's so many limitations, and it won't always play, and blah, blah, blah. But they found a way to take live performance
yep.
and put it on TV.
In a great way, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
a good point. Yep.
Is it intimidating working with guys like Copperfield, Blaine?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, mentally taxing?
Totally. I think especially at the beginning, you know, like getting to work with them and work on movies and other projects in the last couple of years, I've got to meet and work with, you know, some pretty big celebrities. And upon meeting anybody like that, I think you're, you know, hesitant and scared and nervous. And then once you spend like 10 minutes with them, you're like, oh, wait.
You're like, just a dude.
You're a human. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. You're just like me. And especially with magicians like Copperfield and Blaine, like you're even more like me than I realized,
wow.
you know, and it's still scary. Like there were multiple days, like I lived on Blaine's couch for 5 months working
wow.
on Real or Magic. And there were, you know, days once we'd been working together, like 6 of the 7 days, it was just like my buddy. And then like the 7th day I'd have like a reality check moment. I'm like, oh geez, like. I forgot who you were. You know, like,
this man trapped himself in ice for a while
yeah,
and people stared at him
exactly.
and everybody knows who he is.
Exactly. Or like, you know, a lot of the times when you're working with somebody like that, you're in his office for like days on end.
Oh,
and
wow.
then you step outside and you see the way other people look at him and you're like, oh yeah, like crap. I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're David Blaine.
Sure.
Like, and he is amazing and everything he's done is, you know, speaks for itself. But
that was a great special, Real or Magic.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
was.
I've always been a little bit critical of Blaine's stuff, but he has, you know, done a great thing with bringing close-up magic to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And that special especially yeah. was really well done
yeah.
and very clever and
yep.
found a way to just take the same thing and make it different, you
yep.
know?
Exactly. Yeah, and he's just such a incredible performer that, like,
I think he's easy to dismiss too, because I think people lump him in with Angel a little bit, and I think the difference is talent. But
like, non-magicians would compare the two quicker than magicians would. Magicians know the difference, but you're saying, I got you. You're right.
And he, I mean, he has a character. He has a performance style. He's very skilled, you know, and I'm sure to some people it comes off a little bit weird and strange, but to me, he knows what he's doing and he's going for that, and it works.
Yeah, he knows his character. Like, he can snap in and out of it. You know, I don't think I'm really revealing any huge secrets here, but, you know, he's, like, ridiculously funny and, like, kind of a goofball dingus, you know, when he's not performing, which makes it even cooler because he's, like, super fun to hang out with and, you know, be with when he's not doing magic, but, like, the minute he starts performing for somebody, my gosh, it's like I've seen him perform so many times now that there are moments when I know he's fake, I know he knows he's fake, but when you see him really in the zone, you're like, is he, or is this real?
And that's why it comes across so well, and that's why people think he's a real wizard.
I mean, like, him more than anybody I've ever seen, especially in an intimate setting. Like, I think there are definitely people who go and see Copperfield and think that he has real powers, you know? I think it probably happens more for David Blaine because he performs on more of an intimate level.
And he's in people's living rooms.
Exactly, yeah. He's, like, right in your face, and you're seeing him do something 6 feet from your face that, like, you can't explain. And then instead of, like, laughing it off or, like, ta-da, he just, like, stares you down. Yeah,
and that's you know, that's something I can't do. You know, I have to, not take the magic seriously at all. And the fact that he can do it and get away with it, because a lot of guys try to do it and it comes off as Joe Bluth. And he finds a way to not make it that way.
I think it's really important. Like, you know, that's why I love creating magic for him, because I will have an idea or see something that makes me think of a thing, and I'll be like, well, I can never pull that off, but, you know, David Blaine could. And getting to work with him, the ideas I was helping contribute on that team were all ideas that I would never, like, I'm a goofball when I perform, and I know that, and that's what I'm more comfortable with, and I think I can sell that better than someone serious. And I think it's important to know, like, who you perform as and how you're perceived when you perform. And he definitely knows that. And I feel like too many people see him and see him being successful in it, and they try to just rip him off or, like, try to be him because they see that working when it might not necessarily be them.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, for sure.
But it's hard because he's so good at it.
Yeah.
Like, I watch it and I'm like, maybe I could do one serious trick. It's like, because some of the reactions he gets are just, I could never get that type of reaction with the way I perform.
It's you know, it's a thesis course, or it's a I should say a graduate course in magic, just watching him.
And he performs all the time too. I think that's something people don't realize, is that they think that he turns it off and on when the cameras are rolling. Oh my gosh, no, he is always doing magic for everyone. Like, I think the first time I met him, I went to dinner with him and Garcia. And everybody recognizes him, obviously, when you're out in public, but just, like, performing for the servers. And we'd be sitting, nonstop. The chef came out. He went back to the kitchen and did, you know, magic for them, and performing for the hostess and performing for the table next to us and just over at the bar. Like, literally never stops. And his repertoire is so huge that he can literally, like, live jam and, like, in the moment, and it's real. Like, he's not just a TV magician.
That's inspiring, you know. And there's a couple of celebrities out here there who are like that. And, you know, you think that once the cameras are off, they're done, but it's nice that it's not something they're faking. This is just genuine who they are.
Or people might think that, like, they're going to become like him if they make YouTube videos or Instagram videos, and they just make a bunch of them and they never do magic when the camera is not rolling. But I think it's all the stuff he figures out and all the stuff he learns when he's not on camera.
Yeah.
That's what he applies when he's on camera.
Sure. You
know, it's important to be well-rounded, I think.
Yeah. And just, when there are no stakes, mm-hmm. when the pressure's low, you find out a lot more about yourself and mm-hmm. a lot how things work. And
yep.
I was goofing around with Joel last night here at the castle, and somebody asked to see a trick, and he did something, I did something, and it was so off the cuff.
Yep.
And I don't normally do that. I do corporate stuff, and mm-hmm. I do, shows, and so for me, magic is structured.
Calculated.
I'm performing from this time to this time, mm-hmm. Because that's what my paycheck is, I have to.
Yep.
And then just the fact that a deck of cards is pulled out, and it's like, okay, let's do a trick.
Yep.
It was the most fun I've had performing in a long time.
Yeah. I think
a lot.
Blending it and mixing it's really helpful, and a good balance of the two, being able to, I have friends that would argue the other way though, and that I have really good friends that only perform when they're being paid to perform.
Sure.
And, it's hard to argue against it, but I love performing all the time. I am never the guy who is like, can I show you guys a magic trick real quick? Like, I don't think I've ever asked that, but obviously it gets brought up in social settings. And when it gets brought up, if someone asks, I never say no. I'm like, we're in. Like, you guys just don't understand what you just unleashed. Like, it's going down.
I used to always be against performing on command, and we've done episodes on this.
Oh yeah.
But then I've realized it's not someone forcing you to do a trick. It's someone organically being interested in what you do.
Yeah.
And they just want a piece of it.
Right.
And the fact that they're interested in you and interested in what you want to do is, not many people get that.
Right.
If somebody plays guitar, very rarely is someone going to go, "Oh, play me a song," because everybody plays guitar,
but exactly.
In terms of magic, it's a rare, it's not for us, but for everybody else, they think it's a rare thing.
I think it's a choice you make as a performer where, like you said, you can choose, and I don't think anybody would hold it against you if someone asks. You don't have to dance on command. Like, you don't have to, impress me right now, go. Like, you don't have to. It's a choice, but I think,
and when it's commanded like that, that's when I'll definitely say no.
Yeah. It's a little, I think people think they're being nice when sometimes it doesn't come across that way. Mm-hmm. And I'll choose as well, like how to, appropriate that or appropriately respond to that request. Mm-hmm. Because then, you have the great comeback of like, oh, what do? Like, you're a dentist. Like, okay, well, after I'm done, you mind looking at my mouth real quick while we're here at this bar? But if it's someone who asks in a fun way, like, I'm usually dying to perform. So it's just like anybody, even if someone offers it in a rude way or they think they're, getting me, like, I'll immediately flip it on them by doing some cool stuff for them, and they're like, "Oh crap, this is pretty cool." I think that's my approach, is like killing that person with kindness or like killing them with good magic. And like, they thought they had me by, show me something, dance, fool
dance,
me.
Dance for me, monkey.
Yeah. And then like, one approach is like, no, I'm not going to. Or another one is like, okay. How's this?
You want to dance? Let's dance.
Yeah. I love that sometimes, which is fun.
Mm-hmm. And there's, I used to always, before I came here, I was very much against performing for free. Mm-hmm. But coming here, I've specifically been performing in big, cool variety shows here, but, non-paid a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But the experience and the opportunities that come from it, are worth not getting paid. I think you have to play that fine line too. Okay, am I going to get something out of this? Am I going to meet cool people?
It. Yeah, I think especially out here in LA and Hollywood, that term exposure
is dangerous.
But I think that it can be used in a smart way. Like you're saying, if you find out there's a gig or performing opportunity where you do know it's going to be amazing exposure, or even if they promise you good exposure and you don't get it, but I've done a lot of free shows here in LA where they pitch it that way, or I know it's actually not going to be.
Yeah.
But then I just do all new stuff. Like, and if it doesn't work, they got what they paid for. You know, like yeah. you know, and it was a learning experience for me. And I think those are better opportunities to try new ideas and to workshop stuff or even workshop jokes. Mm. Then it might be more scary to try a brand new idea at a really well-paying gig where
yeah.
you know that if it flops, it's a bad reflection on what you're getting paid. But sometimes those free gigs are really nice to workshop stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just depends on the audience. It depends how it's set up mm-hmm. and you know what you can get away with for sure.
Exactly.
We ask everybody this. Do you have a good performing, your best performing experience and your worst performing experience? We've had some pretty good worst ones.
Oh, yeah.
Over the course of episodes.
Oh, I'm sure.
Any come to mind?
You know, I think I love magic for the fact that you can get away with just so much stuff. So even like maybe what I remember as my worst, someone might not have realized it was my worst because like you can talk your way out of stuff. And I feel like I'm a pretty good, I don't know what I can say on here, like BSer, like, you know, I'm pretty good.
You can swear.
Okay, I'm pretty good at like bullshitting my way out of a situation. Because when I perform, I do a lot of like the magician messed up premise.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, like, oops, that wasn't it. And then that was the thing the whole time. Or coming in like under the radar, I do a lot. So that if I do ever mess up or have a horrible thing, people just think it's all part of it. So I think I have that luxury built into the way I perform. So I don't really have tons of terrible stories. Probably like the biggest exposure, you know, like getting to perform on Fool Us or Wizard Wars or I did Fox's New Year's Eve with Pitbull.
Oh, okay.
And so I got to perform on like national television, what was supposedly live, but we pre-taped it like 2 weeks before for the New Year's Eve special. And that was a proud moment, like taking advantage of like the medium, like, you know, knowing your medium and knowing how to push the limits of that. So like with Pitbull, who I'm not super familiar with his music. I don't think he's going to be listening to this.
So I don't think he's super familiar with his music either.
Okay, it's a fair statement. But he was really nice, you mm-hmm. know, very nice. But, like, I was very afraid that, you know, people know magic and people know street magic, mm. and he was going to way overact to whatever trick I did.
Interesting.
So that was my fear. So I lied to everybody on set except for the director. I told the director that I'm actually going to be doing this trick, but I'm going to be telling everybody else we're just going to do a dry run and mime it.
Interesting.
And they rolled on it because I didn't want it to be missed. So I got a real reaction out of him because I did this trick. I created this trick where it's called the invisible card, and you the premise is like, you know, you do like a series of questions to narrow the person, kind of like invisible deck, like mm-hmm. you narrow them down to one card. And then that's the card that's been in my hand the whole time. So, but throughout the trick, you're having them handle an invisible deck of cards and shuffle them and all that. So I asked Pitbull, I was like, you know, are you familiar with cards? Or are you comfortable shuffling cards? And he's like, I think so. And I was like, well, how about we'll just do one. We'll do a dry run where you just mime it. And I'll say everything I'm going to say later. But we won't actually use cards. We'll just do it like an invisible deck. And he's like, oh, great. Thank you so much. So we did the whole thing, and they filmed it and rolled it. I was like, all right, here's the deck of cards. Mix it up. You know, throw away either those or those. Keep those. So you've got it down to one card. Fold that card up. Put it in my hand. And then when I opened my hand, there was the card. And you could see, like, in that moment, what aired was real.
Sure.
And when I showed him the card, it was real because, you know, he didn't think that was the real trick, and he didn't have time to process a fake TV reaction or,
sure.
you know, what he thought he should look like reacting to magic. So I was really proud of that moment, like as far as a good performing opportunity goes, because I took advantage of the medium. Again, like Instagram, knowing it can take 45 takes or it can take an angle to be the best trick possible. And then I did the exact same thing on Wizard Wars. So okay. that was a show where it was like a, you know, Top Chef, where they give you items mm-hmm. and you have to create a magic routine with them. But the only downside to the show was you performed it in front of a live audience and judges, but you performed for that audience twice. So they filmed it twice, and you only performed for the judges once. So, but the time that you perform for the judges is the second time.
What?
I know, right?
Why would they do
that? Right. So the judges are sitting in a room filled with real people, not actors,
yeah,
that just saw that routine. And so I was annoyed because obviously the viewer at home is getting to see all of their great real reactions because all the cameras are pointed at them for that first dry run through. And then there's like one camera in the way getting shots that they couldn't get while the judges are there. So like for the viewer at home, you're getting to see great reactions. But for the judges, you know, trying to decide which, you know, act is better, they're having to watch it with like a stale audience where the reactions they're hearing, instead of being, oh, they're like, oh,
you know, yeah, that's
got it this time.
Yeah.
So that was super annoying to me. You know, and so we took advantage of that. And there was an item in our episode. I was performing with Adam Trent, who's an amazing magician. He was so much fun to work with. And one of our items was a wooden rocking chair. It was a full-size chair. We had to do a trick with it. And you had to utilize all of these props throughout. So during the, we had this great idea for a trick, but for the dry run where they film it and they show the audience, we got to the very end of the routine, and we're walking off stage, and I just sit in the rocking chair the whole time. That's all we used it for. And as we're walking off stage, either one of the producers or like Adam and I kind of jokingly turn to each other, and they're like, "Are you going to do a trick with a rocking chair?" And we were like, you know what? It was such a small time frame. We couldn't come up with anything. So between now and 10 minutes from now, we'll try to come up with a trick. I'm so sorry. Like, we don't have something. And which was complete BS. So they had no idea what we were going to do. And we came back on with the judges for the second one, where I'm sitting in the chair the whole time. And at the very end, we get up to leave. And Adam turns to me, he's like, "Oh, Blake, we didn't use the rocking chair." And this is all on footage, like for the judges and for the audience. And now they are legitimately in on, like they don't know what's going to happen.
Mm.
And then we picked up the rocking chair and we shredded it. And it was all made of paper, just like copy paper. And I was sitting in it the whole time. So that was the trick. But if you watch that episode, the audience loses their mind. And the judges lost their mind. And the wizards, like the other competitors, lost their mind because no one knew that was coming.
Nice.
And so we really flipped the format to our advantage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was a really proud moment as far as like performing goes.
What made you want to do that, and what made you just have the instinct to know that I should do it, like with the pit bull thing or with that, to know I have to do it this way to get it right?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, after working for Blaine, and then I worked for Dynamo for a season on television magic, I saw a very big distinction between people who were talked to beforehand, or people who kind of knew what was going on, and people who had no idea what the hell was going on. And I love the second more, like people's real reaction. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much of that raw reaction you lose when they're talked to beforehand, or when they see the cameras, or
yeah, you know. And it that reminds me of in Blaine's special, as late as when Harrison Ford picks up the orange.
Oh yeah,
just that moment of, you know, as very a magician, real. You're yeah. like awesome, but yep. for him, it totally messed with him, and yeah. he's an actor, and yep. you could tell he was not faking that
exactly. And I think it's so many people, especially like non magicians, like producers and executives on TV shows. They only see value in people screaming and running away from the camera.
Yeah.
And some of my favorite reactions to get when performing are just like the shock and all, like silence. When you can look into somebody's eyes and tell that you just snapped their brain. Like, and that's different for different people. And I think it's important to understand that and have a variety of that within a TV show. but also to want that variety when you perform. Like, you shouldn't be depressed if you do a trick to somebody and they're just speechless.
Yeah.
You shouldn't walk away being like, oh, I messed it up because they didn't cuss me out and run away. Like,
yeah.
You know, you should know that different people react differently. And I think wanting a real reaction was what drove the Pitbull strategy and what drove the Wizard War strategy, was because we saw how it was set up and we saw how that, what that would yield, the result that would yield. And we didn't want that. So we did whatever we could, and that's what we came up with.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Any last parting advice to young magicians, professionals, non-professionals, relatives?
Relatives.
Family.
You know, I've been meaning to tell a few of my family members. No, I'm just not. I think perform whatever you want to be doing. Like, if you want to be performing, if you want to be an inventor, if you want to be both, just do so much of it. I think, like, I've never gotten better advice from people. Just like, the more you perform, the better you get. The more you create, the cooler your ideas. You know, I think it's so simple and people overlook it. But, like, yeah, I think people thinking them doing 10 shows is a lot. Like, doing 1,000 shows is a lot, and having 1,000 ideas is a lot. Mm-hmm. Having 10 or 20 ideas is not a lot.
No, so yeah.
I think that would be advice that I've gotten that I would pass on. I mean, it's definitely not original.
It's cool. None of this podcast. Yeah, no, this has been great. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
We're going to wrap up because I think the Magic Castle is literally opening.
Yeah, we can hear.
They're going to yank us out of
the
here.
The building is shifting as it's wrapping up.
But thanks, Blank. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Nick.
Bye.